Okay, so we'll make a start because I think the PowerPoint's about to come up. So while it just warms itself up, I'll just let you know what we're doing today. We're going to start by looking at the economics and business practices of STARDOM and the ways in which STARS have been operating within the industrial context of production, distribution and exhibition since the 1960s. So it follows on from what we were doing yesterday when we were looking 1920 to 1960. Perfect. It sets out some of the main characteristics of the Hollywood star system, noting how stars have been functioning since the breakdown of the studio system in what we call the post-studio era. I'm also going to be looking at a number of major stars who've gained increasing levels of control over their work by becoming not just the stars of their films, but also the directors or the producers or the directors and producers of their work, producing, directing their own star vehicles. I'm also going to look to some extent at some of the more shadowy figures behind the stars in Hollywood, particularly agents and publicists. And I'll be focusing in particular on Tom Cruise, looking at Tom Cruise's development of his career and the way in which a number of those background people have been instrumental in building him up as a star and maybe breaking him down as a star. So by looking at the role of his agent, Michael Ovitz, and his PR guru, Pat Kingsley. Okay. So, since the 1960s, the Hollywood studio system has crumbled as a result of anti-monopolistic legislation, competition from television, and declining audience figures. Nevertheless, stars have remained central to the new production systems that were implemented to ensure the industry's survival in this new era. And in his book, The Star System, Paul MacDonald has described the key changes that took place in the American film industry from the 1950s through to the end of the 1990s. Basically, this involved the rise of the unit package system, in which independent production companies negotiated distribution deals with major Hollywood studios with at least one star, often two stars, as an integral component of that package. Throughout the remaining decades of the 20th century, Hollywood film stars have gained increasing levels of freedom and control over their work, including a share of the box office takings of their films. So this has included setting up their own production companies, forming partnerships, acquiring percentage of the royalties, the box office takings, and commanding ever-increasing salaries. Stars as diverse as Robert De Niro and Whoopi Goldberg, Goldie Hawn and Sylvester Stallone have all prospered in this new commercial environment. The star I'm going to look at initially is Clint Eastwood. Are you familiar with Clint Eastwood? You've seen some of his films? Yeah, good, great. Okay. Clint Eastwood, as you probably know, became a movie actor in the late 1950s, having established himself on American TV, particularly in a TV western called Rawhide, which ran on network TV in America from 1959 through to 1965, and this propelled him to stardom. After a period of making spaghetti westerns in Europe, in Italy, obviously, in the early to mid-1960s, he then formed his own production company, Malpasso, in 1967. And thereafter, it was his own company, Malpasso, that produced many of his most popular films, including Hang'em High, Coogan's Bluff, Paint Your Wagon, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, Play Misty for Me, Dirty Harry, High Plains Drifter, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Every Which Way But Loose, Sudden Impact, follow-up to Dirty Harry, Pale Rider, and Heartbreak Ridge. Clint Eastwood also became a director in 1971. His first directorial project was Play Misty for Me, And he continued by directing High Plains Drifter, The Outlaw Jesse Wales, Bronco Billy, Sudden Impact, Pale Rider, and Heartbreak Ridge. The Unforgiven, which did very well at the Oscars, Bridges of Madison County, and more recently, Million Dollar Baby and The Changeling with Angelina Jolie, just to name a few. In addition to producing and directing all of those films, he's also composed the soundtracks of 8 of his movies between 1971 and 2014. This makes Clint Eastwood an Oscar-winning producer, director, actor, composer, quadruple hyphenate, according to Janine Basinger in her book, The Star Machine. So the hyphenate is the star who does more than just star in a film. So if they're a star director, they're a single hyphenate. They're a star hyphen director. If they do more than that, then, you know, the more hyphens they get, basically the greater their status. So Clint Eastwood is a quadruple hyphenate. Eastwood is not alone, though, in making the transition from star to star director, star producer, or even star director producer. Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas, and Marlon Brando all set up their own production companies and directed and or produced their own films during the 50s and 60s. Meanwhile, in the 1990s and 2000s, Oscar-winning actor George Clooney transformed himself from a television star, most notably in the series ER from 1984-5 and then again from 1994 to 2009. He transformed himself from a TV star to a film star and then went on to become the writer, director, star of Good Night and Good Luck, which again did very well at the Oscars in 2006. And he then became, more recently, the co-writer, director, star, producer of The Ides of March in 2011. Okay, and it's not just Hollywood actors who are becoming hyphenates, who are becoming director producers. This has been happening all over the world. So we can see it happening in Bollywood as well. So, for instance, one of the biggest stars of Bollywood cinema in the 1970s and 80s, Amitabh Bachchan, also acquired hyphenated status in the 1990s. So Amitabh Bachchan's initial breakthrough was in Prakash Mehra's Sanjeer back in 1973, although it was his starring role in Rashmesh Sippy's spectacularly successful Sholay in 1975, which broke all box office records when it was released in 75. And it held on to that record for at least 10 years in terms of being the highest box office film in India. It was really that film, Sholay, Flames, Embers, that made him a star. During the late 70s, he became one of the biggest and most popular stars of Bollywood, and his popularity and his star profile remained unprecedented until the 1980s, when he was eventually superseded by a younger generation of stars. Bachchan continued to star in films, though, and even became a producer. And in 1995, he formed his own production company, Amitabh Bachchan Corporation Limited, to produce his first film, which appeared the following year. This was Our Dreams. He didn't appear in the film. He was just the producer of this film. He subsequently produced another 7 films between 1997 and 2011, often his own star vehicles, often the films in which he himself appears. Okay. One of the actors who displaced Bachchan as a star in the mid-1980s was Shah Rukh Khan, who is still just about the biggest Bollywood box office star in India. One of the biggest stars on the planet by the dawn of the new millennium, Shah Rukh Khan, often referred to simply as SRK, has millions of fans scattered all over the world, not just in India, but in Australia and New Zealand, Canada, North and South America, the UK, and many parts of Europe, Africa, and Saudi Arabia. Okay. So he's a massive international star. He's been dubbed the Tom Cruise of Hindi cinema, and he's also known as the King of Bollywood. Shah Rukh Khan actually began by playing villainous and anti-heroic roles in films such as Gambler in 1993 and Fear, also 1993. But it was his breakthrough in the film The Bravehearted Will Take the Bride in 1995 that transformed him into a romantic hero and the top box office male, again supplanting Bachchan. This made Khan the hottest heartthrob in Bollywood. Capitalising on his exuberant performances, his boundless energy, and his charismatic star persona, a team of writers, choreographers, costume designers, and film directors transformed this actor into the ultimate brand ambassador for Bollywood and India, and also into the face of the glittering new India that was emerging in the 1990s with the rise of the middle classes in India and the transformation of its industry into high-tech digital industry. By 2000, by the dawn of the new millennium, he was a superstar. He was also well on the road to becoming a superstar hyphenate. In 1999, Shah Rukh Khan joined forces with actress Juhi Chawla and director Aziz Mercy to form their own production company, Dreams Unlimited. So this was a partnership between the three of them. And they worked together on three major productions. Their first production, But the Heart is Still Indian, was released in 2000, but unfortunately it flopped, which was a bit of a shock for Shah Rukh Khan, his team and the company. But their second production, which was a very expensive historical drama called Ahsoka, attracted the attention of critics at both the Venice and Toronto film festivals, and it was also widely promoted in the UK, where it did modest business, but it wasn't a massive hit. It wasn't like any of the hits he'd been having with his other star vehicles in the late 90s. But it was the third film that Dreams Unlimited produced in 2013 that proved to be their most successful. This was Chalti Chalti, or While We Were Walking. This was a big hit for Shah Rukh Khan and Dreams Unlimited. And it was galvanised by the success of this film in 2003 that Shah Rukh Khan decided to go it alone and form his own production company, Red Chillies Entertainment, which has enjoyed huge success throughout the new millennium. He hired his former choreographer, Farah Khan, to direct him in I'm Here For You in 2004. And again, this proved a massive hit. Farah Khan, one of the few major female directors working in Bollywood today, scored a whole number of hits directing Shah Rukh Khan for his company, Red Chillies Entertainment, throughout the 2000s, perhaps most notably Om Shanti Om, which is all about the Bollywood film industry. And it's definitely, if you're not familiar with Bollywood, it's the one to watch first, because it tells you about the history of Bollywood and it tells you about new Hollywood and how different the two things are. Sorry, new Bollywood. So Om Shanti Om. Shah Rukh Khan, by becoming a producer, was able to take much greater control over both his work and his image during this period, but also to extend his ambition. According to his biographer, I can't say her first name for some strange reason, Chopra, his goal is to create a variety of films with production standards and special effects that are basically on a par with Hollywood blockbusters. So the true nature of his ambition is to raise up Hollywood cinema to be absolutely on a par with the most expensive Hollywood blockbuster. Sorry, I should have had that slide on during that. And you can see some of the productions he's worked on there with Farah Khan and also Karan Johar, who's someone else who's directed in a whole number of his films. Okay. So during the 90s, the 1990s, Bollywood was transformed into a high-tech global entertainment industry. Once upon a time, it was run by an older generation of largely uneducated men with little respect for the orthodox business practices of other international cinemas, such as Hollywood. However, in the 90s, it became dominated by a new generation of technological, university-educated urbanites who are often educated in America or Canada or the UK and had experience of cinemas and film cultures in other parts of the world, who brought that to Indian cinema during this period. On the 10th of May 1998, Bollywood was granted industry status for the first time by the Minister of Information and Broadcasting in India, which opened up opportunities for investment by banks and other financial institutions. These required much more formalised operating and accounting systems before they'd invest money into film production, and it meant that film companies had to up their game and become much more professional in terms of their financing systems. So as a result of this, productions became more cost-effective, but also the budgets of Bollywood films began to escalate rapidly. This led to marked improvements in the production standards of Bollywood films. So when, in 2006, Shah Rukh Khan remade Amitabh Bachchan's 1978 tough, gritty underworld thriller, Don, which he had made back in 1978, it was transformed by Shah Rukh Khan's team into a big-budget, glossy spectacular along the lines of Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible. And again, that was the goal. They set out to make a film that had many of the elements of Mission Impossible. In 1996, Tom Cruise reportedly earned $70 million for Mission Impossible. He earned $70 million. $70 million. That's just a number, isn't it? 70, not 1 million, not 10 million, $70 million. Paul McDonald has suggested that these earnings probably did not result entirely from Cruise's status as star actor, for he was also involved in the project as the joint manager of his company, Cruise Wagner Productions. With a budget estimated at $75 million, the film took $181 million just at the North American box office during 1996. It took another $271.6 million worldwide. So it can be presumed that Tom Cruise's cut of those box office takings were what earned him his $70 million. And of course, that also included profits from video and television sales as well, which nowadays are just as large as the cinema takings, if not larger. So this movie then launched Cruise as a star producer, and it was followed by a whole load of others, including The Others in 2001, starring Nicole Kidman, Vanilla Sky, 2001, starring Tom Cruise and Penelope Cruz, The Last Samurai, 2003, Jack Reacher, 2012, in addition to four more Mission Impossibles released in 2000, 2006, 2011, 2015. Well, it's supposed to be, the next one's supposed to be released in 2015. So Tom Cruise is the producer of all of these films, and he takes a hefty share of the box office takings. Now, Janine Basinger, in her book The Star Machine, describes Tom Cruise as a neo-star. And what she means by this is a contemporary Hollywood star that's achieved stardom after the breakup of the studio system, who, unlike Clint Eastwood, was never involved in the older studio system. So he's part of the new Hollywood. She also describes Cruise as an all-purpose superstar and, to date, a truly durable box office champion. With his combination of blockbuster hits with mass appeal and smaller films that challenge his acting ability, films like Magnolia, for instance, that aren't necessarily going to be popular with a mainstream audience, but give him credibility. Basinger claims that, and I quote, as his career unfolded, Cruise seemed to understand instinctively how to be a movie star, adapting a straightforward approach to acting, being willing to play junk when necessary, while holding his own against Hollywood legends such as Paul Newman, Dustin Hoffman, and Jack Nicholson. She suggests that Tom Cruise might even be, and I quote, the last of the red-hot movie stars. Having endured as a top Hollywood star over three decades, he's certainly proven to be a survivor in an industry dominated as much by chance as strategy. Now, P. David Marshall, in his book Celebrity and Power, which was published in 1997, so it doesn't cover the whole career of Tom Cruise, but nevertheless, it includes a chapter on Tom Cruise where he's used as a good example of a film celebrity, not just a film star, but a celebrity film star. Marshall identifies Tony Scott's Days of Thunder in 1990 as Tom Cruise's breakthrough film, in that it marked the triumph of Cruise's picture personality. Here, Cruise, the star, transcended his character in the film, while the accompanying promotional materials and publicity for the film stressed his own interest in car racing and his expertise as a driver himself, so that the truth of the movie text is borne out in the real Cruise. So what we can see happening in this film for the first time, according to Marshall, is we have a part that Cruise is playing in a film that's modelled on what we know already about Tom Cruise. So Tom Cruise has determined the character rather than just playing a particular character. And the characters he's playing are forming what we know of him as a star, his identity as a star. So this is different. The whole movie now is premised on giving us the true Tom Cruise. We know he's obsessed with fast cars through publicity, and here he is in a film playing a racing car driver. The other connection is his co-star is Nicole Kidman, who in real life he was beginning to have an affair with, and gossip about their affair was being leaked to the press. So again, the relationship at the heart of the movie is a real relationship, if you like. So this is a real star text, determines the story and the character. So in this instance, the Cruise character on screen was determined largely by the star's celebrity and the persona that had been developed and disseminated in extra cinematic materials like magazine interviews and photo shoots. This is the emergence then of Cruise as a true film celebrity. Now, just to go back to the earlier phase before Days of Thunder, prior to 1990, Cruise had made his name as a star associated with youth, sport, technology, and enterprise. These were the essential elements of his star persona: youth, sport, technology, and enterprise. He was the perfect young white male hero of the Reagan era. The Reagan era beginning in 1981 and ending in 89. Tom Cruise became a major film star in Hollywood in 1986 with the release of Top Gun, one of the top-selling films of that year. By this time, he'd already appeared in seven films, starring in Risky Business, All the Right Moves, and Legend, with Ridley Scott. In the early 1980s, he was, prior to that, so 81 to 83, he was associated mainly with the idea of youth or American youth, particularly in films like Taps, 1981, The Outsiders, directed by Francis Ford Coppola in 1981, and 1983, and Losing It, also 1983. And in particular, he was associated with youth in terms of pure action, in terms of self-assuredness to the point of being cocky, unthinking and insensitive, and focused to the point of being narrow-minded. These are the key elements of his characters in most of these films from the early 80s. All of this was expressed through his idiosyncratic smile and grin, annoying to some, I know, which soon became a trademark, featuring widely in publicity and promotional materials, as did his Ray-Ban sunglasses, which earned him a lot of money in this early period. In March 1981, Michael Ovitz recruited Tom Cruise to his talent agency CAA, Creative Artist Agents, which in 1981 was fast becoming the top talent agent in Hollywood, hoovering up the biggest names in the business, supplanting one of the oldest talent agencies, which was the William Morris Agency, which had been going since the 1930s. So CAA was a new kid on the block as an organisation, as a talent agency in the 80s, and it was aggressively expanding. And Tom Cruise was a new talent that they groomed and developed rather than just buying up established names. When Cruise was added to the company's list, the young actor was an unknown. 10 years later, having worked exclusively with Ovitz and CAA, Tom Cruise was one of the company's highest earning stars, providing the Creative Artists Agency with a sizable proportion of its annual revenue. It was this company's handling of Cruise that transformed him into Hollywood's biggest global star. Initially, Cruise was established as a physical performer, as I said, young, masculine, handsome, and athletic. And you can see this clearly in films such as The Outsiders, Losing It, Risky Business, and All the Right Moves, which were all released in 1983. Here he embodies white American masculinity, following in the track shoes of earlier generations of stars like Paul Newman and Robert Redford. But at the end of 1983, something crucial changed, enabling Cruise's image to deepen, enabling him to emerge as more than just a type. This occurred with the release of the film Risky Business in August 1983. Have any of you seen Risky Business with Rebecca De Mornay as a prostitute? Okay. With the release of this movie, a plethora of newspaper and magazine articles about Tom Cruise appeared across America. Images of Cruise sporting Ray-Ban sunglasses were consistently used in these articles, establishing his cool attitude. His persona remained connected to the roles he played on the screen, though. So it was the characters he was playing that was basically informing his star identity. And readers of these articles didn't really know much about the real Tom Cruise, who he was as a person, other than the standard biography that had been produced by the talent agency Creative Artists, CAA. Okay, so his persona remained connected to the roles he was playing on screen, and the discourses on Cruise appearing in newspapers and magazines bolstered and corroborated his screen persona. And the effort here was to establish the emerging star as a marketable commodity. His commodity status was heavily dependent on his screen presentations, on what his characters on the screen embodied. And according to David Marshall, the star's developing team of publicity agents began to manage the consistency of the image as he appeared in films for several major film companies, including Geffen Pictures, Universal, 20th Century Fox, and Paramount. So what's happening at this point is he isn't working for one studio, and that studio isn't grooming him and developing in the way that MGM developed and groomed Judy Garland in the 40s, in the 30s and 40s, or the way that Warner Brothers developed Bette Davis in the 30s. There was no consistency of film company. The only consistency was the talent agency, CAA, which now took on the business of grooming and developing Cruise as a star in order for him to be a marketable, lucrative investment on their books. And because they'd taken him on as an unknown and as a young actor without a track record, it was CAA who were getting the big share of his profits. He was only getting a very small salary at this point, a very small cut of the fee that was being charged to these different film companies. So it was CAA that were really drawing the money from him at this point. Okay. Sorry. Dennis Bingham, in an essay entitled Kidman, Cruise and Kubrick, A Brechtian Pastiche, which is included in the book More Than a Method, notes that Cruise was, and I quote, the most successful of the men who became stars at unprecedentedly young ages during the youth film mania of the mid-1980s. He adds that he developed the persona of a callow but cocky young man whose excess of confidence expressed with a 100-watt smile makes him attractive, but also suggests that he needs tempering and maturing. And Bingham notes that most of Cruise's films actually knock him off his pedestal at some critical point in the narrative and make him earn back his confidence in a maturer framework. And citing examples of this being Top Gun, his big blockbuster hit, The Colour of Money, Rain Man, A Few Good Men, The Firm, and Jerry Maguire. So all these films effectively do the same thing. They take an overconfident, immature young man who then gains in maturity only by having the stuffing knocked out of him and having to regain his confidence at some point. For David Marshall, what set Cruise apart from previous generations of American male youths like James Dean and Marlon Brando is that Cruise was never a rebel. Cruise was not opposed to the status quo, either to patriarchy or to capitalism. Indeed, he appeared to be hungry for the success that he could acquire through his skillful and confident management of the system as it stood. He wasn't challenging the system. He just wanted to be a success in the system at a younger age than he would ordinarily be allowed to achieve that level of success. He's always in too much of a hurry in his films to become successful, although he usually attains it in the end after a series of setbacks. So David Marshall has written in his book Celebrity and Power that, and I quote, the connection of youth and confidence through Cruise's persona can be characterised as a celebration of personal will, not to transform the system, but to move smoothly through the system to occupy already designated positions of power and influence. And Marshall observes that in Cruise's films of the mid-80s, success was closely linked for Cruise to sport and technology, to his prowess in these two fields, one or other, sometimes a combination of the two. And so he writes that, and you can see the quote up there on the screen, in the filmic texts, this relationship to the ease of success is manifested around either sport slash athleticism or the management of sophisticated technology. In all cases, Cruise is something of a natural, but also a natural risk taker who goes beyond the bounds of technology or game to demonstrate ultimate human dominance of will. So it's his fiery focus, determination and his will to succeed, combined with his youthful masculine athleticism and his technical prowess that gets him to where he wants to go. And it's interesting how that still works for him now as a middle-aged man in the Mission Impossible films. So some things have never changed. Other things have changed dramatically. Okay, so this, what Marshall's talking about, applies directly to films such as All the Right Moves, to Top Gun and The Colour of Money. Meanwhile, in 1988, in the film Cocktail, which you saw this morning, Cruise was presented as a star by magnifying his particular star qualities. As Marshall has written, Cruise's character Brian Flanagan in the film never separates from our image of Cruise the star. And in fact, the film, through camera angles, obsessive shots of the Cruise smile and grin, and a celebration of Cruise's body and movement, actively plays and integrates the Cruise screen personality into the meaning of the text. This film would make no sense if any other actor was trying to play this part. Cruise as Flanagan becomes very quickly a bartending star, which allows him to act within the narrative as the star. The character is thronged by adoring fans in several sequences of the film. These fans, the bar patrons, the clients in the bar, are predominantly women, and their adulation of Flanagan for his acrobatic bartending skills is connected through the film text to the sexual aura of Cruise as a male star. He acknowledges their looks and responds with even greater histrionics. Okay. So this is an absolute showcase for Cruise as a film star, as a rising star in Hollywood. It's at this point, around 1988-89, that Cruise undergoes another important transformation and begins to break away from his established type. He did this by being cast in quality films opposite an older generation of actors who were acclaimed for their acting skills, most notably, perhaps, Rain Man. With this Oscar-winning, co-star Dustin Hoffman, and with the highly respected director Barry Levinson, Cruise established his credentials as an actor, not just as a star. Despite being acted off the screen by his co-star Hoffman, Cruise emerged as a quiet but strong talent, playing within his established range, but creating a different type of character than we'd seen in his earlier films. And David Marshall has written that, and I quote, "Cruise, through this film, Rain Man, is working to transform his public image from malleable and predictable male film star to serious actor who chooses very carefully the productions with which he's involved." He also adds that a new series of connotations become associated with a Cruise film. Consequently, hereafter, Cruise signifies as a hallmark of quality. So audiences going to see a Cruise film after Rain Man know they're going to get quality features in the film, not just kind of action spectaculars or looks at his body. So this is the era of gravitas, but also controversy. The next step was for Cruise to use the code of acting to fully transgress his film persona, which he did perhaps most convincingly in Oliver Stone's Born on the 4th of July in 1989, the year after Rain Man. Here he portrays an athletic young man, like he does in the early 80s films, but here he's transformed into a paraplegic Vietnam veteran confined to a wheelchair. And this is dramatic departure from his earlier youthful, all-American, non-rebellious roles. He becomes much more anti-authoritarian in this film. Discourses circulating around the film at the time of its release stress Cruise's commitment to an authentic portrayal in his preparation for the role, associating him with method acting. Cruise's reputation as an actor was consolidated in early 1990 when the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences nominated him for the first time for the award of Best Actor in a Leading Role for his performance in Born on the 4th of July. Now, Marshall observes in Celebrity and Power that it was during the early 90s that Cruise acquired gravitas by performing with the older generation of established male stars such as Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men and Gene Hackman in The Firm. However, for Marshall, and I quote, "by far the most interesting of Cruise's transgressions was his 1994 film Interview with a Vampire," Neil Jordan's film, Irish director Neil Jordan. which he notes became the subject of hysterical controversy when shortly after news of Cruise's casting in the leading role of Vampire Lestat, the author of the original book, Anne Rice, basically declared herself outraged by the idea of this all-American, wholesome and youthful star playing her European, decadent, ambiguously gendered and homoerotic anti-hero. Rice publicly disowned the film on these grounds, dissociating herself from the production on the strength of Cruise's casting alone. Because of Cruise, she wanted nothing to do with the movie. She wouldn't endorse it. Yet after seeing the final film, she declared Cruise's portrayal of Lestat to be charming and humorous, and she endorsed the film with lavish praise for both its cast and director. So there was a massive turnaround, which did wonders for Cruise's profile at this point. This film not only established Cruise's range as an actor, but it also highlighted a degree of sexual ambiguity and homoeroticism that could actually be traced back to films like Top Gun. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? The scene in Top Gun, which is excessively homoerotic. If you don't, go on YouTube. David Marshall has noted the impact of vampires' homoeroticism, which is only slightly toned down from the original novel. He notes that Cruise and his co-star Brad Pitt are depicted for the most part as beautiful and handsome representations of masculinity, which ultimately facilitates their success at procuring a succession of victims for them to feed on. It's the conflict between Cruise's dominant picture personality and the transgressive nature of the text that produces a massively proliferating discourse about Cruise and his suitability in the press. Now, at this time, Marshall claims, Cruise's star construction became the site upon which a number of fears about the norms and sexual morality were being activated. He notes, for instance, that just before the release of this film, Cruise appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show on TV, sporting a goatee and long hair, which apparently perplexed the studio audience due to its departure from his previous clean-cut American star identity. Okay, and this is the point I'm going to break off here. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back to a new Cruise and a new Cruise era where this highly managed all-American male icon begins to break down in interesting ways. And I'll explain some of the reasons why I think we see this wonderful, very successful star identity beginning to crumble from this period on. Okay, we'll have a